Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has become apparent, of course, in the first year of the Trump administration that one of the most, well, dynamic, shall we say, and complicated and perhaps increasingly dangerous fronts in that war is one that we perhaps thought no longer was of concern. That was not the view of our guest, I have to say, or I think of this program's host, but nonetheless, it has been widely thought in Washington circles that the dangers that we once faced, the controversial character and the need for very considerable preparedness to contend with Russia, was a thing of the past. Dr. Stephen Blank, I'm pleased to say, has spent his entire professional life, as best I can tell, studying, analyzing, writing about, teaching on the character of the regimes that have governed from the Kremlin for decades now, and is, I believe, one of the country's preeminent experts on what we're confronting at the moment from Vladimir Putin's regime and what is likely to be our lot with that regime in the days and indeed the years ahead. He is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. He has been a professor of national security affairs in a variety of institutions, including the Strategic Studies Institute. He's also specialized in that sort of vein, Russian national security studies in particular, at the U.S. Army War College. He is the author of over 1,000 articles and some 15 books, including Natural Allies, Regional Security in Asia, and Prospects for Indo-American Strategic Cooperation, and Light from the East, Russia's Quest for Great Power Status in Asia, among many others. It is always a delight to have him with us, and we're pleased to say we have two segments with him. Thank you very much, Dr. Blank, for joining us. It's always good to visit with you.
My pleasure to be here, Frank.
Well, where to begin? I guess I feel constrained to say, though it may be something that is of less import than some other aspects of this fraught relationship, with what has been happening since President Trump came to office, really even before he came to office, that has consumed us for now over a year, namely the allegations of Russian, well, political warfare is the way I think of it, influence operations, information operations against this country's elections, its various candidates for president, the threats or the charges, I should say, of collusion, particularly between the Trump campaign and the Russian regime. What do you make of all of this, Steve? As a serious student of Moscow, what do we know now about all of that, and what should we be understanding going forward about it?
The first thing people need to do is separate fact from what has not been proven yet and what has just been merely charged and alleged. The fact is the Russians mounted a massive campaign of intervention in 2016, and it started actually earlier. It started probably around 2014. A massive campaign of intervention against the American electoral process as such. There's no doubt that they tried to interfere to tilt the election on behalf of Trump. That's not to say that Trump's election would not have happened otherwise, but the facts of Russian intervention are beyond doubt. It's not fake news. They attacked at least 21 electoral commissions in the states. They attacked Republican as well as Democrats, but the Democrats were the ones who were most victimized because those emails and networks were made public through Russian fronts like WikiLeaks. They are aiming to overturn the Magnitsky laws and sanctions imposed by the Congress and the Obama administration before 2016. They clearly are doing this not only in the United States, but against all of Western Europe, and now apparently Mexico as well. Mexico is about to hold elections later this year. And this represents, as you say, a campaign of political warfare. Now, what we do know is that the cyber scope of this was quite large. Facebook, Twitter, and similar kinds of organizations are constantly now reporting that they underestimated the size of the Russian efforts to penetrate media technology, and that the numbers are truly astounding when you begin to realize it. But again, there's no way to determine this precise influence that they had in the election. So what really is going on here is not that they intervened on behalf of Trump, although that's the point, true, is that they intervened to destroy the integrity of the American electoral process and are doing so again. And it's not only the American electoral process, it's all of Europe as well.
Yeah, it really does seem as though it's sort of omnivorous that it's working to exercise influence, and it's not entirely clear to what effect, but there does seem, at least I think it's fair to say, based on what we've seen in this country alone, a churn, a turmoil, a preoccupation with it that has, to some extent, eroded confidence in our political system. And that, I would assume, Dr. Blank, you would agree, is a victory for Putin's regime.
I think so. I also believe that was at least one of their objectives. They are the enemy of the Russian government is democracy, not the United States. And therefore, it's imperative for them that they undermine democracy as such, that its validity, its coherence, its international resonance, and so on. And this is part of that campaign. Now, of course, it has a specific geostrategic point of weakening the United States and deranging its political system, as well as that of our allies who are democracies across the world. And this is going to continue because it's relatively cheap. It's very difficult to, as a people expert in the field will tell you, to attribute any specific intervention in cyber to any particular location. And you can almost turn it on or turn it off like a light switch.
And with quite considerable strategic effect. And let me turn to another piece of all of this with you, Dr. Stephen Blank. That is economic warfare also seems to be very much in the Putin kit. They have, we've learned over the past year or so from, among others, our colleague Kevin Freeman, seemingly been very closely collaborating with China in an effort to undermine confidence in the U.S. dollar. There's some talk that the larger purpose is something that Putin has aspired to for some time, which is to remove the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. There's a disagreement about how imminent that is. But what are your thoughts on that score? Is this also part of what the Russians are up to, trying to destabilize or at least undermine confidence in not just our currency, but our economy as well?
Well, economic warfare is taking place. We're doing it against them, and they're doing it against us. But to me, when you talk about the attempt to undermine the dollar, the biggest or the prime mover, I think, here is China. The ruble is not going to supplant the dollar. Not in our lifetime. But the renminbi or the yuan, if I pronounce it correctly, China has ambitions for that. And I think this is a joint effort on their part. The Russians would certainly like to weaken our economic power and position. We're doing it to them. They're trying to do it in their own way abroad. But I think this is largely a Chinese effort. What the Russians are trying to do basically is create a ruble zone, basically in what was the former Soviet Union, or what they call now the Eurasia Economic Union. I don't think it's going to be particularly successful because the ruble is just not credible as a currency. The Chinese, on the other hand, we're talking with a much stronger major economic power with global resonance. And yes, they have been at this for several years. They are trying to supplant or circumvent the dollar, and it's something that I assume Treasury is concerned about. I assume the Trump administration is also trying to counter this kind of activity. But I haven't seen what we're doing. A lot of this also takes place behind closed doors. You're never going to see quite everything, or get a lot of publicity.
But it is a matter of some concern here. Yeah. We have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Blank of the American Foreign Policy Council. His views in particular on what Russia is up to in terms of strategic military capabilities. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting with Dr. Stephen Blank, one of the country's real duty experts on Russia. And before that, the Soviet Union. He is most accomplished in his writings on this subject, his teachings on the matter, and we're always delighted to have him visit with us. Dr. Blank, we were talking about political warfare and economic warfare as parts of this dynamic, relationship, shall we say, with the Russians. Let's turn to another matter that you have been deeply knowledgeable about for a long time, and that is Russia's strategic military capabilities. And I'm particularly interested as we look at the Trump national security strategy and the defense strategy that has flowed from it, the emphasis that is now being given by the U.S. government to Russia once again as a strategic competitor at best, if not a hostile adversary. And one facet of that, of course, is this remarkable and quite alarming, really, strategic force modernization program and even theater forces as well. Would you give us sort of an overview of your sense of what the Russians have been up to and its implications?
Well, the Russian government believes that it's at war with the West. I mean, they have said so. They are conducting themselves accordingly. And they cannot compete with the United States, let alone NATO, in the conventional sphere. So they have put their priority in nuclear weapons. And, of course, they have other reasons, because nuclear weapons allow them to feel equal to the United States. It's a place where they are equal, in a sense, strategically or politically, and because it gives them a sense of being a great power. Nevertheless, they have, and Mark Schneider, whom you often have, and whom I've worked with on this, will tell you this. They have over 20 programs going now to modernize either existing Soviet-era nuclear weapons or build new ones. They are brandishing nuclear threats all over Europe and against the United States. They have a doctrine. I mean, the doctrine is regarded here in the United States as saying that Russia will use nuclear weapons in a first strike mode. If they think they are losing, they will escalate a war in order to de-escalate it. I think that's actually incorrect. I think the broader and more accurate strategy is that Russia is building all these nuclear weapons in order to be able to dominate escalation control throughout all the stages of a crisis. That is, if a crisis begins, they can start brandishing the nukes in order to try and force people to get their way without having to go to a protracted war, or they can launch a quick, what they think will be a quick war, and use the nuclear weapon to inhibit a NATO response. Now, that strategy has led them, therefore, to invest in both long and short-range weapons, as well as not just weapons that target military targets, counter-force weapons, but what we call counter-value weapons, like this monstrous Status 6 torpedo that is underwater nuclear weapons launched by submarines and has no purpose other than to take out civilian targets and cause the greatest possible carnage.
This is the weapon that is assessed to have a 100 megaton warhead, is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, a vast, I mean, unimaginably vast weapon.
Right, hypersonic speed, I think, also, if I'm right. You have to check that.
Underwater, I'm not so sure about that, but I know it is a high-speed torpedo.
Right, so high-speed torpedo. It could take out, for example, Baltimore Harbor, just to give you readers an example.
Forgive me, sir, but I think probably a considerable part of the East Coast of the United States, as a matter of fact. But what I'm interested in is, having worked on these issues for many years, I'm struck by the fact that this is going on, this extraordinary investment, and you mentioned 20 programs. Those are, of course, nuclear weapons as well as modern delivery systems. It's hard for me to believe, having cut my teeth during the Cold War, that this kind of threat could be developing and metastasizing without the United States regarding this as an absolutely strategic peril for us. There is now, as I mentioned, these new strategic documents. The president's got a new nuclear posture review, and it's sober and it's thoughtful, and it seems to be headed in the right direction. But is it remotely sufficient in light of the fact, as you see it, at least, Dr. Blank, that the buildup is quite astonishing? And Mark Schneider, you mentioned, warns that it is going to be violating not only the INF treaty, the Theater Forces Treaty today, but the New START treaty in the future.
Yes. Well, the response, I suspect, is as good as we're going to get, because the only way you can counter the strategy is if Congress authorizes and appropriates the money to devise counter strategies, whatever those might be. And, I live in, like you, and, in the Washington area, and just look around us. The government is closed again today because we can't get a budget out of Congress.
I think they did get something.
The Senate voted at about 2 o'clock in the morning. But again, but still, the workers are not there today. And this goes on every 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks.
It's hard to contemplate a strategic force modernization program on this basis, isn't it?
Right. You can't do that. You can't build a strategy on this basis. But the document, I think, is as good, if not better, than anything we've seen in a long time from any administration. And it really does set out, I think, the threat. Now, there's going to be a debate about this, but the fact of the matter is that we have steadily diminished the role of nuclear weapons since 1991. And along with the Russians, we've destroyed or eliminated thousands of nuclear weapons after 1991. The Russians now are coming back to this. I believe the Chinese are too. And of course, we have proliferators. So there does need to be a strategy instead of just simply saying we're going to do nothing and you just protest. Experience has shown, and you know this from your own government service, that the only way you get meaningful arms control reductions from the Russians is when they are afraid that we're going to develop a capability that they cannot match.
Right. And at this point, that's not in prospect. So we've got to get about it, it seems to me, to be certain. As we look forward, Dr. Blank, and we won't be able to do justice to it, but could you just outline in the shortest of terms what a strategy should be for the United States, given what you've described in terms of the various facets of a Russian threat at the moment?
The strategy has to be multi-pronged. It has to include diplomacy. Information that is countering, not only resisting Russian cyber and information attacks on American networks, but also on bringing information to Russian-speaking communities and to our allies and other communities abroad that tells the truth and exposes the lies that come out of Moscow. It also needs to be military, and that we have to sustain deterrence both in Europe and Asia, as well as be prepared for Russian machinations in places like the Middle East and elsewhere. And it needs to be economic. I would do more about getting economic warfare, such as I would increase sanctions. I think the Trump administration missed the boat on Tuesday when they didn't. I think you need to be doing more in terms of exporting energy to Europe to deprive Russia of markets there, although that's difficult. And we need to sustain the American economy for the long run, because we have to be the foundation of all of our other power is economics, and we have to generate economic power on a steady basis.
Yeah, something that is not evident in the stock market at the moment, that's for sure. Dr. Blank, thank you very much for your time today. As always, we appreciate it and the work you do these days at the American Foreign Policy Council. I hope we'll visit with you often in 2018. Heavens knows we need your insights and expertise.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by one of America's foremost, in my estimation, military leaders. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, a former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, a man who served for 36 years in the United States Navy, rising through the ranks from seaman to four-star admiral. He has gone on since he retired from the military some time ago to be one of the most active and, I think, thoughtful contributors to the public policy debate about national security and what appear to be more or less weekly columns in the Washington Times and appearances in other outlets as well. We're always delighted to have him here, especially because he is, among other things, the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee and an incalculably important ally in what I call the war for the free world. Admiral Lyons, thank you again, sir, for joining us. It's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Nice to be back with you and your listeners, Frank.
We were talking, Stephen Blank and I, a moment ago, Admiral, about what Russia is up to, and it's not pretty, as you know, across a broad front. But one of the things Stephen Blank made very clear is that when it comes to economic warfare against the United States, the Russians seem to be, well, certainly collaborating with, but kind of taking a back seat to communist China. And I'd like to visit with you a bit about what China is up to specifically, but not exclusively, in terms of its military buildup in those waters that you were used to be responsible for in the South China Sea, and the possibility we're being told that it's really spoiling for a fight with us, an old-fashioned kinetic confrontation and conflict, perhaps. Your thoughts on all of that, sir?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Frank, because this is the subject of my next op-ed, which hope to have out should be out next week. Look, there's no question, and I agree with Gordon Chang, China wants to pull the trigger on a confrontation. And what we have to do is think ahead. We cannot afford to keep putting our ships and aircraft out there to make them tempting targets without having thought through and what we have as backup to respond to these forced confrontations. And this is what I used to do with the Soviets. Whenever I would do a freedom of navigation and where we'd have a ship out there, apparently by its lonesome, I had already pre-positioned aircraft and other resources to respond to any forced confrontation. I was not going to hang them out there to dry. And this is what we have to do with the Chinese. We know what they're up to. You just can't be putting ships and aircraft out there. Even these are, and what we're doing is perfect, is all in international airspace and water. So what the Chinese are doing, and it's, you know, the Chinese arrogance. It's like, you know, we had the cowpens who tried to surveil the Chinese carrier first operation. And the display by that time of the cowpens commanding officer was, in my view, a disgrace. You know, when you try to show deference to the Chinese, they see it as a weakness and they'll move on it. We've got to pre-position forces, aircraft, surface, and submarine, be prepared. And actually, what the Soviets, when they saw what I was doing, they thought I was trying to sucker them into a confrontation. And if we can reverse the table that way with the Chinese, so much the better.
Yeah. Admiral Lyons, this is such an important point. I worry as we watch what the Chinese are doing, even if we were to do all of that, and we're certainly not, it seems, as you say, we're kind of putting vessels or even unarmed aircraft in harm's way and inviting almost them to take advantage of the situation without the kinds of consequences that might dissuade them. But I worry that we're not thinking about a permanent presence. We're talking about at best simply showing the flag. And I'm wondering, Admiral, whether, and we've talked about this, so I don't know what your views might be, but I'd be interested in whether if we had the kind of relationship with the Philippines that I think both countries know is needed, whether having an American atoll out there in the Scarborough Shoals off the port of Manila might be the kind of counterpoint to what the Chinese are up to. It might precipitate the conflict you're talking about, but at the very least, it gives you some kind of permanency to contend with what they're building, for example, there.
Look, Frank, that's exactly the point, because in 1991, when we were forced out of the Philippines, that's when China declared the entire South China Sea as their territorial water. And you couldn't be more on target. If we reestablish a permanent position at Subic Bay, and there's no question we would change the equation out there significantly, because it's an indication we're here to stay, and we have the resources, and we're ready to respond.
So you would recommend simply making that presence in Subic rather than, you know, creating some man-made islands out there adjacent to what the Chinese are claiming outside of Subic and Manila that would, you know, be a forward line of defense, shall we say?
Scarborough Shoal is well within the economic zone of the Philippines. It's Scarborough Shoals is 600 miles from the Chinese mainland. As the tribunal court, the Maritime Tribunal Court in The Hague declared, what China's claims are totally illegal, and they have no basis in the maritime law.
Let me turn to another topic with you, Admiral, quickly before we run out of time for this segment. When you look at the totality of what the Chinese are putting into place in terms of the capacity for conflict with the United States, I know you've often said on this program and elsewhere that we have fewer ships in the entire United States Navy today than you did under your command back in the 80s. Do we have anything like what we need to deter the Chinese? And if not, what should we be doing differently now?
Well, the problem is, under sequestration was the worst act that ever could have been taken against our military. Regretfully, the things we need are capital investments, and you don't build them in a month or 6 months. So we've got to come up with an innovative way to rebuild our Navy, including possibly purchasing hulls from our allied overseas markets and so forth to jumpstart a program that we must have desperately. And of course, you can't be putting out fake ships, and I'll call the literal combat ships are not a combat vessel. It's, to me, it's nothing but a target, and the Chinese view it that way. In fact, when they toured, when Grenad, which was CNO, had a Chinese CNO tour in LCS, the guy just laughed at the inadequacy of the ship, and that's what we were counting. So we really have to get serious on rebuilding the Navy and our Air Force as well, because we are desperately short of the resources that we need to reestablish the credibility and the level of deterrence. And that's what we're really talking about. We don't have the level of deterrence that we need today.
Yeah. We were talking about that problem with Stephen Blank at the nuclear force level with Russia. I think it's unfortunately probably equally the case with China these days. But certainly in terms of our power projection capabilities, our conventional forces, naval and air, as you say, Admiral, the idea that we are in fact able to practice peace through strength is deeply problematic and something we do have to get back to. Admiral, we're going to come back to you in a moment for a second segment. We'll talk about, among other things, a military parade and other issues that are now confronting our military with Admiral James Ace Lyons, former commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Admiral James Ace Lyons is in the house virtually. We're thrilled always to have him with us, but especially at a moment when President Trump has said he is persuaded that we need to have a display of power and an opportunity to honor the efforts and sacrifice of our military men and women with a 4th of July parade modeled after and surpassing, if he can do it, the Bastille Day parade that France has long undertaken to celebrate its Day of Independence. Let me ask you, it's a day of revolution and the establishment of one of their republics. Admiral Lyons, your thoughts on this subject. I gather that the military is saying thanks, but no thanks. Should that be the right response?
That should be the right response. If you want to do something for our military, first of all, what does the parade do? You're bringing in units from all over the country at a tremendous cost and effort and taking them away from their families when the time that they do have at home should be spent with them. And the expense of organizing and bringing it in when we're under such tight fiscal constraints to me makes absolutely no sense. If he wants to show, the president wants to show some special recognition of our military, let him give them a week off without charging them their leave on so they can spend with their family. Let him give the military a special bonus to recognize the great sacrifices they made.
Yeah. Admiral, to the extent that we, as you were mentioning a moment ago, are really suffering the cumulative effects of this sequestration policy, the dangers associated with inability to do the sort of planning, let alone to undertake new starts that are needed, as you say, with respect to naval vessels and so much more, when we're dealing with continuing resolutions and so on, has impelled many in the Congress at long last to say, look, we need to get out of this. We need a 2-year budget. The price that is being extracted from them by Democrats for getting that kind of predictability and stability in our defense expenditures is exorbitant. But how important is it for us to get onto that kind of planning and execution basis fiscally for our military's future viability and ability, as you say, to achieve peace through strength?
Well, it's absolutely critical. The same way, if we're going to retain our technological edge, which is certainly in question today, we cannot continue on the continuing revolution. And what the Democrats have done for this to try and extract these exorbitant sums to support illegals and other unsavory characters in the country is just unconscionable. And this needs to be surfaced time and time again. There's just no way we can continue with. We must have the solid planning so we can do the new starts. We desperately need these new starts. The budget caps must be removed. Sequestration should be canceled.
Well, the president seems to be intent on doing that, and I'm hoping that he can do it on terms that are not going to compound enormously the budget deficit and everything else, which is certainly, as you say, in addition to the amnesty for illegal aliens, one of the other features of the deal that's being cooked up, as I understand it, to pour hundreds of billions of dollars into, it seems, unnecessary domestic spending just to get some money that is desperately needed, long overdue, for the United States military. Admiral, as we're talking about technology challenges that we're facing, I know that you have been concerned, as have I, about a particular facet of the threat that is now emerging from both the Russians and the Chinese, among others, I guess now, India and perhaps in due course a host of other countries that are proxies for or clients of those states, namely hypersonic and maneuvering missiles, ballistic missiles in particular, that are designed to try to defeat our missile defense systems. What should we be doing to try to make sure that we can contend with such threats and, again, deter them from being used against us?
Under this new review that's ongoing, clearly what's been presented so far is nothing more than some old dust-off stuff. We need innovative technology, and fortunately, there is one available. It's called HIT, Hypersonic Intercept Technology. It's a software that has been proven thousands of times to be able to have a success rate in excess of 95% against hypersonic and maneuvering warheads. And this is something that needs to get on immediately. We must go ahead and can do operational tests with this innovative software. The beauty of it is it works in all our existing systems. You don't have to build anything else. All you've got to do is incorporate the software and its algorithms. And it's why we have been wasting years and years on trying to get this to the forces is unconscionable.
Admiral, speaking of the forces and unconscionable, one of the other things that we've talked about from time to time, but I'd like to get the current reading from you on, is what has been happening in terms of, social engineering of the United States military. It seems as though we're now adding to the mix of the whole gays in the military and women in combat and now transgenders in the military. The idea that we're going to somehow accommodate, according to General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, these dreamers who are here illegally, even though it's not entirely clear who they are or whether they can pass the requisite background checks, that somehow they're going to be protected in the military itself. What is going on here, Admiral?
As I've said many times, when you want to take a country down, the first thing you do is weaken the military. And of course, that's what sequestration was all about. And compounding that was the social engineering mandates that were forced on our military by the Obama administration. Obama's executive order, 13353, which declared that diversity is a strategic imperative for mission accomplishment and readiness, is pure nonsense. This is faculty lounge logic and was nothing but a cover to force the social engineering mandates on the military. What's disturbing to me is, you know, on day one, if I were the acting Secretary of Defense, the rules of engagement would have been changed on day one. On day two, all the social engineering mandates would have been canceled. And why that has not been done is mind-boggling to me. This latest junk about transgenders in the military is pure nonsense. Dr. Phil McHugh, one of the leading psychologists, who was the former head psychologist at Johns Hopkins, declared this is not a civil rights issue. This is a mental disorder that needs treatment and understanding and should never be forced on the military. You know, nobody has a right to serve in the military. It's the commander-in-chief that sets the standards, and these standards are being lowered each day. The latest one by Marine Corps officers who not have to complete their combat obstacle course as part of their training. And the reason behind that is because only one female has only been able to complete that course. So what do? You lower the standard.
Admiral Lyons, as ever, thank you for your candor and for your leadership, which continues at the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, for which you are its distinguished chairman. Thank you as well for your extended and extraordinary service to our country. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.